Welcome to the Fair Cop Podcast. I'm Rob Jessel.
And I'm Ellen White.
And our guest today doesn't need any introduction. She's an artist, an illustrator, and until recently, editorial cartoonist at the Morning Star.
Many of you will know her story. If not, we recommend you check out the excellent podcast with Megan Murphy.
Recently, Stella's case has taken on a somewhat more sinister development. So here to talk that and also to talk about the wider issue of artistic freedom, I'm delighted to welcome Stella Perrett.
Oh, hello, Rob. Hello, Elle.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks very, very much for joining us. So for those who may still be unfamiliar with your story, can you give us a recap of what happened to you and why you were forced out of the Morning Star?
Yes, certainly. Well, first of all, you mentioned I was an editorial cartoonist. I was one of several cartoonists they use regularly, including Martin Rolson, who's well known at The Guardian. With the Morning Star, nobody is paid. Everybody just does it for the cause, you know, to keep them afloat. And so, but I could say that I was the one they used the most regularly over the 5 years I was with them, almost every week, and had a very close relationship with them, very good relationship with them. And I was very pleased to be their main cartoonist. I mean, they called me their star cartoonist in print in the paper, so they did think quite highly of me, you know. And I was with them for 5 years. So it was a big shock when all this happened. It happened completely out of the blue. I was very naive. I didn't know hardly anything about the gender critical world at all when it happened. And people who know this already may have read about it, may have heard about it, but I'll just quickly say what happened, that I submitted a cartoon, as I did two or three cartoons every single week, on issues that were in the news. This one happened to be about the proposed reforms to the Gender Recognition Act 2004, which everybody knows about now. And I thought, well, this will make a good cartoon. Did a cartoon which I thought was amusing, to the point, sent it in with a little explanation of it, didn't hear any more about it. And when I didn't hear anything, I assumed they hadn't used it, you see. So I would just forget about it and go on to the next things I was doing, you know. And I heard in a roundabout way at work, when somebody in the union came up to me and said, oh, a cartoon of yours has caused a fuss at the Morning Star. And I knew nothing about it. This was at work. So and afterwards I made an effort to go online and have a look, and I saw that they'd been made to apologize for it. So they printed it, but then they'd been forced into making an apology. And people like Private Eye wrote about it, and everybody, you know. And apparently one apology wasn't enough. Then a week later, they had to write a huge big thing, 600 words, I think it was, about how awful they were for having printed this cartoon, you know. So it wasn't very nice, because obviously I was an unknown artist, really. And my name and my reputation, such as it was, started to be trashed all around the world on Twitter from people who didn't know me, didn't know anything about my artwork. Probably had never read the Morning Star in their lives, a lot of them, and naming me as a transphobe, which is, you know, really, these days seems to be the worst thing you can be called, you know. And this word TERF as well, which I didn't even know what it was.
But I understand it didn't stop there with insults, and that the new development is that you've actually been reported to the police for a hate crime.
We have spoke earlier about this, Rob. I am in a state of limbo that I do not know what is going to happen. I heard 4 months after the event that it had been reported to the police as a hate crime or a hate non-crime incident or whatever it is they call it. I've been advised to go for a subject access request. And at the moment, I'm in a position, the only way I knew that this had happened was with a private conversation with the editor of the Morning Star. And that was followed by a reporter, the Sunday Mail, the Mail on Sunday, emailed Avon and Somerset Police to try and find out what had happened. And he got a little confirmation by email that, yes, there had it had been reported. But that is literally all we know.
Mm.
And have no idea whether they're going to pursue it or pick it up after. Because obviously the police have been extremely busy with other things for the last few months, you know, with the COVID and the lockdown and policing everything that we're doing, you know, in our family homes and everything. So I have no idea when they might pick this up. But I do know from other cases that it can be months, years later even, that the police continue with things. So I am in a limbo situation at the moment.
Yes.
It is quite worrying. I'm just producing a book of my cartoon review of the year. I'm having to go through it page by page to make sure in my own mind that I'm not repeating anything that other people have already called a hate crime.
Now that
you see what I mean?
That's a really good point, actually, because the next thing we wanted to really ask you about is that obviously it's not the first time that artists have drawn the wrath of trans activists. So we've had, you know, Rachel Rooney, Rachel Ara, the famous artist Birdie Rose, Just of Oz. There's been a lot of attacks in this area on freedom of speech, but now we're seeing this growth on freedom of expression, particularly in artistic freedom. Now, obviously, the arts is typically a very left-wing, liberal sort of sphere, so perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised by that. Now, how do you think this atmosphere is actually going to affect the ability of artists to take those risks and push those boundaries and to actually express themselves?
Well, clearly you are self-censoring. Everybody is self-censoring now. I mean, the best art you create is when it happens spontaneously, where you have a good idea, you wake up in the middle of the night, you think, oh, that's a great idea for a cartoon, scribble it down, do it the next day, send it off to somebody. It's very spontaneous. If you're going to have to spend half your time self-censoring yourself, oh, maybe I'd better not do a cartoon about that, you know. Well, it takes all the fun out of it for a start, but it's clamping down on freedom of speech for everybody, isn't it?
I mean, if you look back at all the fuss that the cartoon caused, would you draw it again, do you think?
I think that's impossible to say, because I didn't have the knowledge of what's been going on when I did the cartoon. I did it purely as a reaction to a story that was a hot potato in the news in that particular week. There was two big things going on. There was the Labour Party leadership candidates signing the trans pledge to throw members of the Labour Party out who mispronoun people. That was going on, and this thing about the GRA as well. It was real big news, and that's why I did the cartoon, and that's the only reason I did the cartoon. Do you know what I mean? I had never, in the whole 5 years I'd been with them, that was the first cartoon I had done about the GRA. So it was literally because it had hit the headlines. And so, no, I can't really see that I would have done anything different, because I was just reacting to a news story the way I always did as their political cartoonist.
At the time of the Yilan's Post and Mohammed cartoons crisis, Douglas Murray said that it would be difficult to imagine a more innocuous way of starting a necessary conversation than with a joke, with a cartoon. And we're seeing the same sort of unease, well, that's rather a delicate word, vitriol would be better, I suppose, displaying itself whenever you try to make a comment. It's like people think that cartoons should be as balanced and as sober as news reporting, which isn't really the point.
Well, absolutely. And the minute you say that, you might as well say that all journalism should just be the voice of the state. No, you have to have satire and you have to have critical voices. I mean, the most recent example is Emad Hajjaj on the bank holiday weekend, who was arrested and detained for 4 days in Jordan for doing a satirical cartoon about the peace deal with Israel and the UAE.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, the international pressure that was piled on top of Jordan, he is released. He's still allegedly waiting for a trial. And that was purely because of a cartoon which was satirising the peace deal. Now, that's happened in another country where obviously they've got a more heavy-handed, obviously they've got police, military, it's a kingdom. So it's not like a democratic country. But that just goes to show an effect that a cartoon can have. And you've got to ask yourself why. Why, when somebody could have written about that peace deal, acres and acres of newsprint probably has been written, people don't have the same knee-jerk reactions that they do have to cartoon. And I think the reason is pretty obvious. A cartoon, it has an immediate effect because, first of all, people will understand it if it's not their first language. You know, if they're a foreigner in the country, they would still understand the message of a cartoon. And also, it takes people back to the days when they were children reading comics. There's literally something about the bright colours and the little animal characters that probably revert back to when they were a child, and they have a childish reaction to it. And that's the only way I can explain it.
It's like trans activists see themselves as beyond reproach, and they always frame every question as an attack on themselves, as an attack on their existence even. And it's an incredibly effective tactic. You just say that you were offended and you usually get your way. So I'm interested in, you know, what's the effect of this tactic on public debate and on related things like satire? And indeed your work as a cartoonist.
It's not just this issue, obviously. There's three main others, which are anti-Semitism, anti-racism, anti-Islamism. And other cartoons have fallen foul of that. And we can we only need to go back a few years to Spitting Image, the original Spitting Image puppets, which were absolutely, they were pretty savage, let's face it. I don't think they'd be able to do that. They're talking about reviving it, but how can it possibly be anything like it was originally? It will be reported as a hate crime, won't it? You know, if they even try to match it to the original. And even the makers of Spitting Image have admitted that they've had to get some sort of experts in to advise them of how best to show black people. And this is absolute nonsense, you know. And of course, all the old comedy shows that are being censored on streaming services and the BBC and so on, you know, I think it's just, we've come to an age of other people have said it much, much better than me, but it is a crackdown, isn't it? It's a crackdown on free speech.
Mm-hmm.
It is a general crackdown on free speech. Not just transphobia, not just anti-Semitism. It is just general. I don't consider that my issue is an issue about transphobia. I consider it to be a free speech issue.
We're actually talking now at the beginning of the trial of the alleged accomplices in the Charlie Hebdo massacre. Now, it wasn't so long ago that we were all Charlie. We all said we valued the right of people to draw and to say things that made us feel uncomfortable. But that doesn't really seem like the case now. Do you think that publications are losing the appetite to tackle difficult subjects?
Well, only last week they've actually reprinted the one or two of the cartoons about Prophet Muhammad that caused that. Actually, they reprinted it because of the trial. And apparently tens of thousands of people have been demonstrating in Pakistan in opposition to them reprinting that cartoon. I think the editor and the journalists at that paper the worst has already happened to them, you know. So they obviously think, well, you know, we owe it to our dead comrades, as it were, to reprint these cartoons. But they are setting themselves up as targets. It's ridiculous. I mean, that's in the heart of Europe, in a civilized country, France. It's perfectly possible for somebody to come around their office tomorrow morning and have another go, you know. The way things are going, people have told me to be very careful. I mean, this what happened to me didn't just affect me. The fallout affected friends of mine. I'm not actually on Twitter or Facebook, but friends of mine are. And I have a friend who has a 17-year-old daughter, and they were attacked on Twitter just because they knew me. They were abused so badly, they were really frightened. You know, I had a 17-year-old girl on the phone to me in tears. And she was frightened for me as well. And she was saying, oh, Stella, they could come around your house. And I said, well, if they come around my house, they're going to be done for harassment, aren't they? They're going to, the police will arrest them. You know, but to a child, to a young girl, it's hard for them to understand. They live on Twitter all the time. They see all this hatred, all this abuse all the time. It really frightens them, you know.
I mean, what's really baffling, and I'm sure anyone who's followed this debate for any length of time has had the same thought, is that all the people making complaints and, you know, freely using words like bigot, transphobe, you should be cancelled, delete your account, this shouldn't be allowed to be said, I'm going to report you to the police, all this, is none of them think this is going to happen to them. They are creating... they're trying to create a world that they think they want to live in, because they think they are building some new utopia where they cannot possibly be wrong and they themselves will never be challenged.
Oh yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, the people who were trying to kick me out of my union and who threatened the Morning Star with defunding were trans activists who are embedded in the major trade unions. The Morning Star didn't have a chance. I mean, I'm actually going to do a thank you page in my book, and I'm actually saying, thank you, guys, I know it wasn't your fault, in my book that I'm going to publish, because I know it wasn't their fault. But you're absolutely right. And the thing is that, like you say, what kind of society are they trying to create? They call to defund the police, yet at the same time, they're trying to threaten people with all this... lock them up, get them chucked out of their jobs, cancel them. Who is going to enforce all that? Are they going to have their own militias? You know, I mean, I quite agree with you. They don't even know what kind of world they want.
I mean, there have been some other developments, especially in sort of culture circles. On the left, there's this idea that you should always be punching up. What would you say to the critics who think that your cartoon was attacking a vulnerable minority?
Well, the Free Speech Union took up my case, and they you can see on their blog the letter they wrote to the Morning Star, and they made the point that actually women could have took offence at the cartoon because it showed them as vulnerable newts sitting in a pond as sort of prey animals, you know, and they could have been offended by that as well. There were different ways to read that cartoon, obviously.
It used to be that the left and right could land punches on each other through various mediums, including through jokes, cartoons, and satire. But as some people have said, and I think Andrew Doyle, the creator of Titania McGrath, I think he pointed this out, this isn't about left and right anymore. It's about old-fashioned liberalism against old-fashioned authoritarianism.
Yeah, very much. I think left and right is almost defunct over this issue, especially this issue. It doesn't seem to matter what political background people came from. They're on the same page over it, you know. So, yeah, definitely. You're asking about more right-wing comedians on the TV, on the BBC. One I can think of is Andrew Doyle with his... very funny, Titania McGrath, who is a takeoff of a sort of woke activist. Well, that's not punching down. That's having a go at the stupidity of some of these people, the ridiculousness of it all. That's not punching down, is it? And if people refer to him as a right-wing comedian, I think he's very funny. So, but I don't think he's punching down. I think it's possible to be funny without doing that.
Do you think maybe that we're getting to a bit of a situation where, unless you are wholeheartedly embracing, championing, almost throwing yourself to the ground at the feet of sort of very left-wing causes, if you're just providing sort of comment that almost is neither left nor right, neither supportive nor kind of decrying the activity, but just poking fun, that automatically then gets seen as being something that's hateful. Almost this silence is violence type of approach to things, where if you're not
because
reporting,
you never can be far enough. You never can be enough in their camp, because however far you go, they will always want you to go more. And even in with the trans people, they actually throw their own people off the cliff and say they're traitors, or they're not real trans people, or they never were real trans. You know, there is no loyalty among these activists. They don't have particular leadership, do they? They're just loads and loads of disparate little groups, all scrabbling, if you like, for media space, really. So from that point of view, you know, and it's very easy to make fun of, But the funny thing about what happened to me was that I really hadn't been doing any of that at all in 5 years. You know, the targets of my cartoons had been what the Morning Star wanted, like the monarchy and the police and austerity and the gig economy and all that. And it just happened that this subject was in the news. It literally was almost accidental.
Trans activists have been very successful in getting their messages across, but that's only part of their strategy. They feel it's just as important to silence those who criticise and contradict them. Do you think that's going to have the effect that they intend?
Well, the general public is just going to reach what we now call peak trans. I mean, this just happens to more and more people. They only have to see it on the television, somebody coming out with something really stupid, and that's another person. You know, that's another person sort of clicking over onto the gender critical side. And that's happening all the time. Look what happened with the Labour Party. I mean, their supporters deserted them in droves because they didn't think they were concentrating on issues for ordinary working people, but talking about all this nonsense. And I'm sorry, I'm calling it nonsense because it is nonsense. You know, if it was a valid scientific belief, I mean, it's not even a belief, it's a delusion. You know, if it was a real scientific thing, then that people could, you know, that they could be taught in school and it was in textbooks and it was genuine, then nobody would care, would they? You know, we'd all be quite happy. But it's just that it is something that is the general public just looks at it and that you've got to be kidding me, you know?
I think the thing that really characterises the whole of the trans debate is the climate of fear. If you look at any of the people, the politicians, you just see the pure terror in their eyes. We saw it in the Labour leadership debates where all candidates, when it came to the trans question, they just went glassy-eyed and they repeated the Stonewall lines. You saw it in Joe Swinson's disastrous appearances on various TV and radio programmes. Ed Davey recently was on the radio, the question came up, and he looked frightened. Why is there so much fear amongst the grown-ups, the people who should be making sensible, informed decisions?
I remember we were watching Lisa and Andy talk about this, and just her face was just one of abject terror, really. She knew that question would be coming, and that out of all questions, to be perfectly honest, there are so many questions that you'd imagine would be far more terrifying for a politician than whether or not females' single-sex spaces need to be maintained.
Yes.
But that currently...
Something very odd about it.
Yes, yeah, it seems to really be overwhelmingly powerful to be able, there doesn't seem to be anything that really truly compares to that one specific issue.
No, there isn't. We experienced that on August Bank Holiday Sunday at Speaker's Corner, when we were down there with the Standing for Women group, and the BLM marchers were routed past us. It's all over the internet, and their trans activists decided to abandon their march and confront us instead, and it took them 15 minutes to get them to move on. And in that 15 or 20 minutes, we experienced a great deal of intimidation. And this was women, not just men. This was women shouting these mantras at us, you know. And I mean, you know, it didn't turn into a roughhouse. I mean, the police were there. Nobody could get away with anything, really. But it was very intimidating.
Mm. Just for the sake of some clarity, I mean, I think there have been some leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement within the UK have come out and sort of disassociated themselves with that particular branch of that refer to themselves as Black Lives Matter, particularly in comments posted to make more noise, which I think is... Mm. But again, I mean, I guess this is the problem, like you were saying before, with very sort of disparate groups and the lack of leadership in it being almost very, say, one way or the other, really.
You only have to see how that happened. That happened out of the blue, quite by accident. If it had been 15 minutes later, we would have been in the pub and it wouldn't have happened. So the fact that they were inspired just by seeing us, to start that confrontation, maybe this is what politicians are scared of then, you know, that it can happen just like that. And, you know, the minute they open their mouths in front of a microphone, that could be the end of their career.
It seems like the worst thing that anybody can be these days is to be a bigot or a transphobe. Whereas in the past, it was being, I don't know, a heretic or a traitor, say. If you look at the history of cartoons, you see people like Gil Ray and Crookshank being accused of lèse majesté for their depictions of the Prince Regent. Or in the 20th century, wartime cartoonists like Philip Zeck being accused of defeatism. The point is that they were all exonerated in the eyes of history. Do you hold out any hope that the Morning Star will hold their hands up and say, "I'm sorry, Stella, we were wrong"?
Oh, well, I mean, in the case of the Morning Star, no, I burnt my bridges with the Morning Star. And I have had an extensive private conversation with the editor. And he cannot see a way forward because he is under such pressure from the unions to print things from trans activists to prove that they're on the trans activist side. You know, otherwise they're going to have they're going to have the rug pulled from under them, you know, and there will be no Morning Star. So, there's no going back in that sense. But I intend to go forward. I've got other people who have been using my cartoons. I'm currently with uncancelled.co.uk. Mm-hmm. And that's a Jewish site, actually. That's a news comment site, which is very pro-Jewish. So these different news comment sites are springing up all over the place now. It'd only be a good thing.
So, yeah, that moves on really quite well to the next point we wanted to ask about how we actually start this fight back against censorship. So, obviously, we've seen last week the interactions between the Spectator and the Cooperative over this issue, over the idea of corporations being able to pressure newspapers and into you know, shaping their editorial line. And obviously Andrew Neil kind of shut that down very quickly.
Also the anarchists who blockaded the newspaper depots last weekend as well. People across the political spectrum united against that. And the more people do come out and speak out, and a magazine like The Spectator in January, the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten, China tried to have them basically... You know, China tried to create a diplomatic incident over it. And that was another cartoon. And China took an exception to it. They wanted the editor and the journalist to be paraded in public and denounced like they do with people in China, you know. And not only did the newspaper stand up and defend its journalists, but the Prime Minister of the bloody country stood up and said, no, Denmark has a proud tradition of free speech and satirical drawings, and it's going to continue into the future.
Yeah.
So the more people do actually stand up and speak, it will have a domino effect, and more people will have the courage to do it.
Yes.
And that's why I am not afraid to. I am publishing a book. I have no idea what the backlash is going to be. I have employed a PR company, and the PR company said to me, "Well, if there is a backlash, it means even better publicity." That's their attitude.
What one thing on that point, what do we lose if editors decide to censor some subjects because they think they might offend a minority? Because I know we've spoken about the pressure that the Morning Star is actually under in this, but you sort of do get to a stage where you start thinking, well, if the pressure is so great that the risk is that they go under, they're not able to do what they're doing, that's not really what the choice is, because if the pressure is there, they're already not doing what they want to do. They're already not actually delivering what they want to deliver to their readership. They're already being forced into basically not being in control of their own paper anymore. And it's almost...
Yeah, unfortunately, the Morning Star's a bad example because they're not a real, in inverted commas, newspaper, because they are just the mouthpiece of a political party. They're not in either of the two regulatory bodies of the newspaper industry. The NUJ really, or I suppose some of them are in the NUJ, but it's not a real newspaper in that sense. So it's a bad example in that way. But the Spectator certainly is a very good example of somebody really really kicking back against this. Mm. And Andrew Neil, fair play to him. He's old enough, rich enough, been in the business all his life, very well respected, journalist and commentator. And I see him as the equivalent to J.K. Rowling. I think it's that important, the stand that he's made. Mm.
And there, I think we have a possible way out of the situation we find ourselves in, which is when you see censorship, you stand up and you call it out, because this can't last, because the people who seek to silence you don't actually believe in what they say they are fighting for.
I think we've got this almost unsustainability of nobody can be 100% perfect, as you were saying yourself earlier, Stella, in this conversation, that nobody's ever going to be able to be good enough, and eventually everybody's going to be cancelled. It's completely unsustainable.
Yeah. Well, I am quite prepared. I don't have anything to lose. I don't own a house, I don't own a car, I don't have loads of money in the bank, I'm now semi-retired, I don't have anything to lose. I'm prepared, if the police do decide to come after me again, I'm going to make it worth my while. I'm publishing a book, which if people then want to call that out, I'm prepared to go to court and defend it as free speech and make it a test case. And I don't care, and I think I don't care anymore. You know, once you've been cancelled, once this has happened to you, nothing else can happen, you see. The worst has already happened. You might as well stand up. You might as well stand up because, the worst has already happened to you, you see.
Well, that's a very positive and indeed defiant end to today's podcast. Before we go, just a reminder that Stella's book, 2020, The Year We All Got Cancelled, will soon be available in all good bookshops. And in the meantime, you can follow Stella on Spinster at Artist Bristol. That's capital A, capital B. But for now, many thanks to you, Stella, for joining us, and all the best from FairCop, and I'm sure from our listeners, in your fight for freedom of expression.
Thank you. Thanks very much.